You know, we've been here for 17 times now. And the second half of Mark chapter 7, verses 24 through 37. And the title for this is, Did Jesus Really Say That? And we are entering the second half of a carefully constructed section in which Jesus' ministry moves from the Jews to the Gentiles. And most scholars describe this section as not as chronological or sequential, but thematic. In other words, we can't use Mark's ordering of these stories to map out Jesus' journey. But it's meant to be seen revealing what Mark's perspective on what Jesus' theology of mission is about. And so today we'll look at two miracle stories, two stories about signs that show two very different ways in which Jesus interacted with people requesting his help. Throughout Christian history, the first of these has been particularly troubling to read and interpret. And many ways of reading it have been suggested to soften what is seen as rather offensive in the story. And the second story, too, contains some odd actions that could be puzzling. So the first story is, did Jesus use a racial slur? So we'll first read from the account in Mark, and then we'll read the parallel account in Matthew. So verses, chapter 7, verses 24 through 30 of Mark. And from there, he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and he begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. But she answered him, Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, For this statement you may now go your way. You may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Matthew's version of this account is found in chapter 15, verses 21 through 28. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon. But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, Send her away, for she is crying out after us. He answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and knelt before him, saying, Lord, help me. And he answered, It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. She said, Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered her, O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. So when we look at these two parallel accounts, there are some key differences. So what do the differences tell us what maybe Mark was trying to emphasize?
He didn't have the disciples tell her to go away.
Right. And so in Matthew, we have the disciples who are annoyed. Mm-hmm. There are no disciples in Mark's account.
Mm-hmm. In Mark's account, Jesus was annoyed.
In Matthew's account, this mother approaches Jesus and pestering. There is nothing of that scene in Mark's account.
Uh-huh. He's almost just
the woman
dismisses her.
Yeah, the woman just comes to Jesus, and then Jesus responds immediately.
But in Mark's account, he said that he was trying to go into a house unseen.
Right.
So Jesus was trying to maybe convey to everybody that he didn't want to. He wasn't open for miracle business at the time.
Another difference is that Mark, in Jesus' response to the mother, has this phrase, "Let the children be fed first." Mm-hmm. Matthew omits that phrase.
Oh, he just says you shouldn't give their food to the dogs. In Mark, he implies that they might get some food after the children are fed.
And the reason for the healing in Mark, it is for this statement, "You may go your way."
Uh-huh.
In Matthew, it is
for
your faith.
Your faith. So, what do you make of these differences? What is Mark trying to communicate?
The whole thing is just so strange. It always has been.
Mm-hmm. Mark stating that if you annoy God, you can find a loophole and get out of it.
Well, one of the key differences is in regards to this idea of faith. In Matthew, yeah, it is faith that leads to healing.
Right.
In Mark, there is nothing of faith. So it's not...
It's not about faith.
It's not general. About... Mark's concern is not about faith.
It's about God does what he will do when he will do it. And it's not because of what you do.
I think it's more about actually knowing your God.
For Mark...
Your God's mindset enough to be able to understand where his will for you lies, like what...
In other words, for this statement.
For Mark, the woman already has faith when she comes to approach Jesus.
Uh-huh.
For Matthew, this incident is a test of faith for the woman.
Uh-huh. I see. So, in Mark, it's not about testing the faith.
It's already assumed that the woman, the mother, has faith. Now, this story also has some parallels to some earlier stories that Mark has related. The one that is most clear is the story of Jairus. The synagogue ruler who comes to Jesus regarding his little girl.
Yeah, and he's a Gentile.
Jairus is a synagogue ruler. He is a Jew.
Sadducees, Pharisees, or something, or just...
Oh, okay.
He's a synagogue ruler. Doesn't say what sect he might have adhered to. But he is a prominent member of the community. He is known by name.
Okay.
And Jesus responds and goes to his house.
Mm-hmm.
Recall that it was part of the sandwich story where it started out with Jairus coming to Jesus to ask, falling and asking for Jesus' help. And then Jesus' journey there is interrupted by a woman who had the problem
with bleeding.
Mm-hmm. And in that meantime, the daughter dies. And when Jesus gets to the house, and he makes all the mourners leave, goes into, takes Peter and
James and John,
goes in, and the parents, goes into the daughter's room, and raises the daughter. So Jesus is present. He actually
Yeah. As opposed to simply declaring from a distance. And then she, like, goes away.
So, you know, looking at the similarities and differences, what do you make of what is Mark trying to tell us, tell his audience, with this this story that we're looking at now about the woman who's a little girl, Gentile woman? You know, it's your high school and college compare and contrast essay question.
It's still strange. It's still.
Who seems to have the greater faith? No, it's not about faith, but if we're asking about faith of Jairus versus this mother, who seems to have the greater faith? Recall that when Jairus was told that his daughter has died, it's accompanied by them saying, well, don't bother the teacher anymore.
Yeah.
And then Jesus has to encourage faith in Jairus.
Uh-huh.
So obviously the mother has more faith by just going straight to... By insisting on help. By insisting on needing the help of Christ to get her daughter saved.
Uh-huh.
Is there any guarantee that Jesus would help a Gentile? You know, nearly all of Jesus' work up to this point has been for the Jews.
But she probably has heard word about Jesus helping people who wouldn't otherwise have received assistance, whoever that might be.
It probably just still required a massive amount of faith or just sheer desperation on her part to go ask for the help of somebody that she just really doesn't know the actual answer that she's going to get for.
Now, so this woman approaches Jesus in confident that help will come. What is Jesus' response to her? Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.
Not only no, but you're not worthy.
So is that what... You know, what is that what Jesus meant?
Why on earth does he say that?
Now, for the Jews, a dog is unclean.
Uh-huh.
Jews did not keep dogs as pets.
Really?
They may have been used to guard sheep.
Uh-huh.
But they were not... You know, Jews did not associate with dogs.
Interesting.
The language there is such that the word dogs means little dogs or puppies or a household dog rather than a mongrel.
Because that's when she says that even the dogs feed off the crumbs of their master.
Uh-huh. Under the table.
The Greeks and Romans kept dogs as pets.
Uh-huh.
And she was a Gentile.
So, should we read this from a Jewish perspective? Or should we read this from a Roman and Greek perspective?
Roman and Greek perspective. Gentile perspective.
Otherwise it wouldn't make any sense that she was able to counter with the act of
under
the
dog the table.
Eating with its master in the first place. Because the Jews wouldn't have had any relationship with a dog other than it guarding sheep. They didn't consider sheepherders very, very...
Yeah, and
citizens of their
calling a Jew calling some thing or someone a dog was a definitely a racial slur.
Right. Uh-huh. It was a condemnation of the standard of that day.
But she doesn't take it as such.
And so scholars are very divided on how exactly to interpret that.
Uh-huh. At the same time, though, what in the literal meaning of a pet, it still is kind of the lower rung.
It's still degrading.
It's still saying that, so why would you take the food out of the mouth mm-hmm. of your child at the table and give it to your dog? Mm-hmm. Your pet that feeds underneath you.
Mm-hmm. So,
but that the pets are usually your kid's best friend because they want to give them all the stuff they don't eat.
The more traditional interpretations have focused on that word of the dog that meaning little dog or a puppy rather than a mongrel, a wild dog.
Okay.
Some of the more recent scholars. Some of the more liberal recent scholars have noted that Mark's gospel deals a lot with Jesus' humanity. Uh-huh. And maybe Jesus is reflecting his cultural frame of reference. And that up to this point, he believes that his mission is for the Jews.
To save the Jewish people.
And it is only in this encounter that he realizes
that he himself discovers
that, his prejudice.
Weird. Interesting.
Which gets to the question of, if a person doesn't realize his prejudices, her prejudices, is that a sin? Because Jesus was without sin.
So the lady was actually saying to Christ,
"You're wrong." Not,
no, she wasn't saying you're wrong. He asked her a question. It's not supposed to be out here.
Hello? Yeah, with our booster?
No, her phone hasn't been working.
She switched to a different
away from the baby's room.
Oh, Shelly, away from the baby's room.
So, when Christ asked her that question, he wasn't asking her per se.
Okay.
She was actually answering a question in her own human mindset, her own humanity, not as a test question, but as, well, if a dog was at my table, wouldn't they eat off of the crumbs of my children then? Mm-hmm. Like, basically saying the cascading effect of my generosity toward my family, my children, will trickle down to the people and the lower beings around me if I have that generosity then. So that was the moment for Christ to realize that in himself. He was actually asking, like, well, why would you care? And she was the one that broke his mindset by saying that her generosity was brought to those dogs through her children, through her, then. Is that kind of what Mark is trying to get at, then? Or the scholars are saying that he might be trying to get at?
Perhaps that... according to some of these scholars, Jesus's divinity has been emphasized
too much
in the past. Huh. And maybe reading Mark through a more human Jesus, we see how Jesus is far more limited in his ability to know and understand.
And
that he learns as he interacts and has relationships with different people.
As in, maybe in this instance, he's beginning to discover his mission to the Gentiles.
Right.
As opposed to, he knew all along that he was going to the Gentiles, and he's just now letting other people in on it.
Or that there was an absolute, and the reason why God was never able to come to humanity as God was that he was never able to understand humanity's problem with being imperfect. It's like somebody that's, you know, like whenever you sit around with a friend or a sibling or a spouse and you have these conversations where you're on the outside looking in and you seem to always know what the other person's needs to do. But since you're not actually in a situation like that, being stressed upon to make the wrong decisions because of that person's situation that you're standing here looking and going, well, I can see that you need to do all these things. Maybe it was that God coming as Christ needed to happen so that God could understand and build a relationship with humans because he was able to see in those instances as he was learning his relationship with humans. That right there was his own moment
discovery. His
little people to give him an idea as to what he needed to be doing for them.
Weird.
That is such a foreign way to look at it. I mean, compared to...
But it's almost logic. Yeah. It's almost right in line with logic, because if you think about something where a smarter or more enlightened person sometimes is considered stubborn or vain or indifferent of other people because they're unable to explain their impression of something or their idea without making it sound too complicated all the time. Uh-huh. You know, they're the Sheldons of the world. They don't have the ability to dumb themselves down enough to actually have a relationship with somebody that isn't necessarily below them, but doesn't think the way they do.
Or they don't have the ability to accept learning experiences from people they see as lower.
Yeah, or even get, maybe not even accept, but not even be able to see
see that there might be something there.
That they could learn from that situation. So it might be way beyond the aspect of diminishing the divinity of Christ, but actually showing that Christ had to learn how to be human in order to develop a relationship with them in the first place. Or learn what a human was, because that right there is a dramatic... If you think about it that way, if you're reading it that way, mm-hmm. if you're told to read it that way and understand it that way, then what it's saying is that God himself had to come here to learn how to talk to us in the first place, because not only are we standing here going, oh my gosh, you're so great, he's standing there going, it's like communicating with May. It's like, how in the world am I supposed to mold you when you don't understand what I understand about you falling off of a table right now? It's the same thing. It would be much easier because you watch her run around with another 2-year-old and they seem to be talking and they sit right down and they do things together and they have these little conspiracies and they're running around and they never say a single word. I'm like, what the heck? You know, and the same games that they play all day long, I mean, they run after each other in a circle and then you come home and you're like, let's run around in a circle, and they're just like, why are you running around in a circle? And then they're sitting on the floor crying, and you're like, what am I doing wrong? You know, I'm doing the same thing you just did for a half hour with somebody over there. It might be as simple as that, and that's kind of a refreshing.
Yeah. So, now, I think there's different ways of reading that may contradict each other, but, you know, maybe it's okay. You know, we can learn and get different things out of different ways of reading.
Well, it's a very refreshing idea because it definitely makes you think that...
It's bizarre. We never heard that concept before.
No, because we get our idea of what is perfect from kind of Greek philosophy. There is this absolute perfection. And maybe that's not what it really means to be perfect. Perfection isn't some kind of this absolute standard which never changes.
But that's what Mark's been trying to develop in his story for a while, is that it's not about... Well, a lot of the stories are with all the disciples, or the writers have been trying to lessen the ladder, like to try to make it so that there isn't a gauge per se, but that we have a relationship. And perfection is a singular component. Like, basically, when something is perfected, that means that there isn't another one like it, because it's perfect.
Now, we assume that, traditionally, Christians have assumed that Jesus, has always been, and will be perfect. That from birth to death, as a human, he is absolutely perfect, and in some way that then means that he knows everything. Even as a child. Some of the infancy narratives of Jesus.
He didn't cry.
Has some really bizarre things that going on.
And that would basically nullify the whole reason for him to come here to be human in the first place, wouldn't it?
He wasn't actually being human.
Right.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, if he was fully human as, our doctrine states, then Jesus had to learn.
So there would have been no reason for the devil to take him up on the hill and tempt him in the first place.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, why would he be tempted? I've always wondered that. Like, why are they telling you this story if Jesus was perfect?
And not able to be tempted.
Why did he even care? Why did he... He's like, so you're taking me up on a hill. Of course I can do that.
But maybe it wasn't that easy.
It wasn't that easy. There had to have been a reason why the heavens broke and cried when Christ went down. Because there's got to be a reason for... There's got to be an amnesia for God when he came down here. There's got to be a reason why everybody lost their marbles for him to leave. Because... You're basically saying that God left without the knowledge of the heavens, per se, when he came down here. Mm-hmm. You have to read it that way, otherwise
that makes
it loses...
even more amazing than just being perfect automatically.
Now, there's another way of reading it.
No, I don't want to read it any other way.
The other way of reading it is to see this as a riddle contest.
No.
We already read it that way, though, because when you read it...
It's more than that. Traditionally, it's been read as... So Jesus uses this word...
She's testing. He's testing.
He's testing her.
Yeah.
And... this goes a little bit more beyond and deeper than that, where the closest parallel in antiquity to the conversation between Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman is the riddle contest, in which the solution of the riddle gains for the protagonist access to desired reward or status. So the woman does not so much win an argument as solve a puzzle. The woman solves the riddle by changing the terms. In her answer, the descendants become little children, and the streetcars become puppies under the table. Unlike the Jews, the Greeks and Romans kept house dogs, as we know from literary sources, relief sculptures and vase paintings. In reliefs and vase paintings of meal scenes, it is common to find a dog depicted as sitting or lying under the diner's couch or table, sometimes munching on a tidbit apparently claimed from its master.
Like today.
Thus, by changing the cultural context, the Syrophoenician woman solves the problem of priority by replacing the image of sequence and implied scarcity, the dogs eat last if there is anything left, with an image of simultaneity and abundance. The puppies will do fine on what the children feed them from their own plates. In addition, the woman's image transforms the Jewish believers from tekna, descendants, jealously guard standing on their privileges, to paideia, the children, those with no status or claim, who alone will receive their privileges to Paideia is the puppies, the dogs, those with no status or claim, who alone will receive the reign of God.
Huh.
So, in this way of reading, the woman's answer transforms Jesus' original statement into a completely different setting. Rather than, you know, the Jews being
the favored ones.
The favored ones.
Uh-huh.
And with, you know, dogs receiving only what is there afterwards,
uh-huh,
what might be left, the crumbs.
Uh-huh.
The woman says, but see, in our culture,
uh-huh,
the dogs don't get just what's left.
The dogs, mm-hmm, get fed alongside
the dogs
by
get
the
fed
children.
Alongside. There is no scarcity. There is an abundance of food for both the children and
the
dogs.
You're inventing the scarcity.
Yeah.
But that's still kind of... even though it's a riddle, it's just going back to either Christ knowing the answer to the riddle, pardon me, but letting the reader realize that riddle, that cultural difference had to be made,
uh-huh,
for those, uh-huh, Gentiles and those Jews to understand where Christ was coming from, for that to start spreading out into the world past the Jewish community.
And
to give that relationship,
right,
for those Gentiles to God.
And so this arc of Mark chapters 6 through 8 is a story of the gospel going to the Jews and to the Gentiles. The first part of this arc, Jesus feeds the 5,000. That's in Jewish territory. Jesus performs signs and miracles in Jewish territory.
Uh-huh.
Now he goes to Gentile territory.
That's when they crossed the sea and he left the disciples. That's at that point. We're on the other side then. You're in the unknown world by then. And that's why the disciples are acting all hoity-toity.
Well, and the idea of the riddle, that leaves room for Jesus learning in that moment.
Well, it does and it doesn't. It says that Jesus, because the designer of a riddle always knows the answer.
But one reason why this riddle scenario is quite probable is that because of Jesus' response to her. For this statement.
For this answer.
You may go your way. It's not for your faith.
Right.
It's for your... You have bested me. This
right.
is the this is the only time in Jesus' entire ministry, in all the Gospels, where Jesus is bested in a verbal match. It's by a woman. A Gentile woman. A pagan.
Weird. Huh.
So, as a designer of the riddle, your riddle can be changed because of the context that in which she changed it. It answered it,
mm-hmm,
but it also completely redesigned it when she did it, thus showing the design of the gospel that he was going to be, that should have been being brought by him while he was here.
It's like she's redefining the gospel to him. Weird.
Yeah, a commentary read. Faith is the expected word here. As in,
uh-huh,
Matthew.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But that's not what Jesus says. It's for this saying. No, I am going to reward you because you beat me.
Wow.
Weird.
Boy, if some doctrines would have hung on to that, can you imagine all the women presidents we'd have right now? But that's a depiction of, again, the lowest form of human in the Jewish society.
Uh-huh. In the Jewish perspective,
not only actually talking to God when she wasn't supposed to, but actually creating a smarter conversation to the point where it threw their laws out the window. And, because the whole parody of, like, the guys walking down the street with the rabbi trying to be able to buy a Lexus and finding a way through the loophole to be able to buy that and be like, yeah, I'm still a good person or whatever. it almost throws that at the face of, mm-hmm. of the religion, too, because not only did she find a way to create an answer, but she also created an answer that brought more humanity and value to everybody below her as she was doing it.
That increased the humanity of Jesus.
Yeah.
That enhanced and bettered the humanity of Jesus.
Well, it didn't get her way. It didn't just suffice to get her outcome the way she wanted it. It actually created an outcome that bettered in the entirety of the known world around her with what Christ was supposed
to be
doing
with
this time.
It's like she's transforming Jesus in that moment.
Right. Like, she literally redefined how he was supposed to conduct himself in his human form. Either way, in the riddle form or in the newer way of reading it, either way. And I bet if Mark was alive, or when Mark wrote that, if he was standing in a Jewish community when he wrote that and they all read that, they would have flipped out and been completely 100% annoyed, because that would have just basically said that it would have been a pretty controversial thing to say at that time, I would assume.
Jesus' mission is transformed by a Gentile woman. That's kind of freaky.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so the other thing before we leave this particular story is, again, it's, you know, food is mentioned. Food is a very prominent theme in these chapters 6 through 8 of Mark. Of feeding, you know, the 5,000 is going to be bracketed by feeding the 4,000. The idea about, you know, unclean versus clean, all of these, and food, you know, crumbs. So overall, you know, the message here is that, you know, Jesus as the bread is being offered to all of humanity, not just to Jews, but to Gentiles, and that there is abundance. In the feeding of the 5,000 and feeding of 4,000, there is more than enough to go around. Next story is a mute man. So Jesus heals a mute man and then tells him not to speak. chapter 7, verses 31 through 37. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay hands on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Although a crowd brings a deaf and mute man to Jesus, Jesus takes him away in private. Now, why would Jesus do that? I mean, it's not like Jesus has done that before. Now, earlier in, as this part of the story opened up with the woman, the mother, you know, Jesus wanted to privacy. Mm-hmm. Now, throughout Mark, we notice that Jesus only wants privacy. Mm-hmm. He's not one to go about proclaiming his powers. And then Jesus, in this story, takes some really odd actions which are not found in most other miracle or sign stories that he performs.
Uh-huh.
He kind of pokes in the man's ear.
He's like an incantation.
He spits and then touches the man's mouth. Well, it's almost like you can almost see it as magical.
Why did they write they? Because he didn't say in the story, it didn't say specifically. He said to the man, "Don't speak." He said they keep proclaiming.
Well, he told them to not speak.
Oh, Jesus charged them to tell no.
Well, I mean, when the man returns from his private audience, which must have included some disciples because this story is here.
But it's always the disciples that are either part of the keep it quiet or part of the don't keep it quiet part of Mark's story.
In Mark, Jesus charges the crowd to not say anything. The recipients of his miracles are frequently told to not say anything about it.
All right, I'll let you finish. I'm sorry.
I mean, the crowd, after seeing what has happened with the man, knows something has happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there other situations where he tells the disciples not to say anything? Maybe in other books?
I think in chapter 8 coming up, can't be sure, but I think he tells Peter to not reveal that he is he's the Son of God.
Okay.
So
there is that also, but not here.
So that was the story then, was that so that's him saying that he healed a deaf blind or deaf mute person, but told him not to say it.
Right.
But he doesn't say in the story that he told the man anything.
Well, them would include the man.
He told them. Okay. So he told the crowd who
witnessed it.
Yeah.
So, these actions could be almost rituals, magical rituals. He's previously healed with simply words or just a touch.
Yeah.
Why?
Why does he use the rituals this time?
Now, there's some evidence that in the Greek and Roman culture, spittle was viewed to have magical curative properties. For the Jews, however, spittle was unclean.
Unclean.
So maybe it has something to do, this whole ritual has to do with demonstrating that there is no clean or unclean.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And perhaps because he is in kind of this pagan area.
Environment
that he is accommodating some of the understandings of the people.
Well, he has to, because if he was in the Jewish community and he went through all the rigmarole to be born of David, even though he was born of Mary, line, just so that Jewish people could accept him as a Jewish person, then of course he's going to... I mean, that would be like going to the middle of the pygmy forest and lighting a flame and not having everybody freak out. He has to abide by some of their ritual, otherwise they're not going to believe that it was possible for that person to be healed in the first place. Hmm. It would be witchcraft if he did anything other than show some form of how it happened.
Huh.
So, it doesn't... We don't know precisely the reasons why, but one of the reasons may be that Jesus has a particular concern with personal relationships, that he wanted to touch this person.
Oh, he just, just happened to want to stick his finger in the guy's ear. Yeah. Give him a wet willy. Well, no, see, this almost, this is really funny because it, well, no, what's really funny about it is the conversation we had before this.
About not eating, you know why?
About the standardization thing. Oh. Because here Christ already knows the outcome and the answer to the equations. But in a room full of people that are sitting there saying, well, why in the heck would that tiny pillar hold up that beam? That's impossible.
So he is... So he is, from your point of view, he's,
in short, showing why
by accommodating the standardization, accommodating the requirements of the culture, of the...
Yeah, because if he just walked in and he was healed, then there's the possibility that the people would have been like, well, he wasn't deaf anyway. Uh-huh. In a way, I mean, I'm not saying that that's true, but it seems like, in a way, if Christ is doing these things now, it's because he has to, a little bit, show that there's part of...
Yeah, so, it's continuing on here. This story is seen as an allusion to Isaiah 35, verses 5 and 6, which talk of the coming kingdom as... including, you know, opening ears and opening mouths, allowing people to hear and speak. Let's see. So, you know, Jesus is, through these signs, it's not simply revealing God's power, but he's revealing God's kingdom. Uh-huh. That the kingdom is here.
Has arrived. Yeah. That makes sense.
But why... Why ask people not to tell about it then?
Well, no, see, that's the odd thing. Part of it in Mark is that the gospel cannot be fully communicated without the crucifixion and the resurrection.
So, and that hasn't happened.
That hasn't happened yet.
In other words, it's not going to make sense.
Right. The gospel, the kingdom, none of it is going to make full sense until the whole story has been told.
So he's saying, don't talk about it because without the rest of the story,
the story is still incomplete.
Huh.
It's not about powers and healings. It's about dying.
Well, right. They're going to run off and say the most... Yeah. You can't have it being proclaimed as done because it's not done. It's not done yet. They haven't... The most powerful thing hasn't been...
Oh, the lasagna?
The most powerful part of God being on earth hasn't happened yet, so...
So the assertions that will be paraded about are absurd.
Yeah.
So, in the last few minutes, final thoughts. What do these two stories reveal about the gospel? Who is the gospel for? What does the gospel do? So, you know, what these two stories do is that the gospel anticipates and it provides evidence for future Christians. For mission to the Gentiles.
Yeah.
No, it's not just for the Jews. The gospel is not just for Jews, it's for the Gentiles. It's about breaking down boundaries. You know, people are great at creating boundaries. And Jesus is shown breaking them. If Jesus is breaking boundaries, then we too
should be breaking
boundaries.
But in the second story, he's showing that you have to do that within the cultural guidelines of the boundaries that you're trying to push back. Because, I mean, that would be a green light for every evangelistic to run out and be like, yeah, we got it started again here, boys. Because that would be, you know, that it's almost like saying that now you're spurring that on, that you need to go out and... Once again,
yeah,
But on that second mm-hmm. story, he's saying, well, here's, we're getting it started. It's going to the world. The rest of the story really hasn't been written yet. So tread lightly. Just don't go out and just shove me down everybody's throat and say it's going to be great. We still have a ways to go with it yet.
And in the first story, this boundary crossing of gender is a very big thing. Because by Jesus stating that this woman has bested her, he is giving up honor. In a shame honor society, it's a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. If she won, that means
he lost,
that he has to give up honor and she gains honor. And what do these stories reveal about Jesus and his values? Again, the role of women in Jesus' ministry. Jesus is always including women. He does not turn women away.
Well, it's because even in that society that even the called dogs of the street had more chance of being brought through somehow to honor, where a woman still at that time, even if she was prominent, was never really let past a certain point in society.
Yeah, another value demonstrated in the first story is that in Hebrew tradition, arguing with God is a good thing. Christian tradition kind of seems to discourage it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in Hebrew Jewish
Just
society,
have faith. Don't doubt.
Arguing with God is a good thing. Abraham did it. Jacob, too. Mm-hmm. This whole arguing is not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
David did, too, didn't he? Or he just went against.
The Jews don't think much of Isaac. Is it Isaac? No. Jews don't think much of Abraham offering Isaac without argument.
Oh, he should have argued.
They think he should have argued.
Huh.
They also don't think much of Noah.
Yeah.
Because Noah doesn't argue with God when he's told, when Noah is told that the world will be destroyed.
Abraham is told that Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed, and he argues and ends up saving his nephew.
Yeah.
But the entirety of Jewish culture is derived around dickering.
It is. Middle Eastern culture is values verbal debate.
And not just in debate, but in all aspects, like the, like you're saying, the zero-sum lifestyle means that, if you don't like to haggle on something, don't go to the rest of the world, because almost solely Americans are the only people that say, that's the price, all right, I'll pay it. And not just monetarily, though, with a lot of stuff.
But with other things, too, yeah.
Yeah, so just last little bit here. Let's see. This unit, the entirety of Chapter 7, radically expands the inclusiveness of the Kingdom of God. It includes a redefinition of cleanliness, a major value in the Jewish and Greco-Roman worlds, breaks out of the boundary of Galilee into Gentile lands, and crosses boundaries between male and female, even showing Jesus' honor being challenged by a witty Syrophoenician woman. If we miss all this boundary breaking and the inclusiveness of the kingdom, we miss the gospel's essence.
Mm-hmm. Boundary breaking was the essence of the gospel, basically.
Now, the concern for the for Mark's original audience, which would have been Roman Christians, would have directly spoken to this priority of the gospel, to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. And that is probably a misinterpretation of some of God's actions and some of the words of the prophets. So, you know, in Acts 6, there is a problem that arises. The Hellenized Jewish Christians were being neglected in order in favor of the Hebrew Christians. So if that was happening, then what about racially mixed communities? Where do the Gentiles work? Where do they come in? And so what Mark may have been doing with this inclusion of this story of the Syrophoenician woman is that there is no priority. You are all, God.
Everyone gets fed at once, the children and the dogs.
Yeah. And in fact, they're...
The whole family. The
whole family. So,
and that's the earliest point that starts to come out then.
Earliest point as in...
Well, because Acts was after Christ. That was after cross had happened.
Right.
So there was still, the boundaries were still very vivid during all the way up into the Roman world of John. They're still dealing with this boundary of
this
some
idea
oppression.
Of boundaries is going to plague the church from the very beginning.
Different types of Christians and which ones have more value.
Right, because we started... Corinthians was where they were talking about Apollo and Cephas and stuff. So even within the actual church, there was the divisions that Paul was having to write about. After all of that happened.
Has there ever been a time when division in the church wasn't an issue?
Well, that's way back when I asked Mark, did the church that we're trying to read about ever exist? And it almost seems like, no, it never had any chance to ever be created until Christ died on the cross. But even that is never given the... It brought us together with it's a catalyst, but the church still has never actually depicted that scene.
Yeah, there has never been the perfect church. It has always had problems.
Even in Acts, the church...
Even at the very beginning, there were problems.
They had a vision of something good, but actually implementing it...
And Peter had to be given a vision in order to feel comfortable enough to go to Cornelius, a Gentile.